Hey everyone, it's Pastor Brian Ross from Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I want to welcome you to another midweek video this week. And yes, I am representing for the big game this weekend between Michigan and Michigan State, letting my loyalties and affinities be known here. Go Blue. I'd like to welcome you to our YouTube channel here, Grace Life Bible. If you haven't already done so, if you would consider subscribing and ringing the alarm bell. As a way of saying, with our ministry, we go live from our assembly building on Sunday morning, as well as when we create content for you here midweek. We'd certainly appreciate that. You can probably tell my voice, I'm still dealing with some congestion and just gunk and yuckiness with being sick. But I did have some time, and I wanted to try to get in a second video this week in this series and dealing with the giving my thoughts on the Textual Confidence Collective. Our featured book for this week is my book, Don't Pass Over Easter, A New Defense of Easter in Acts 12:4. And as I said earlier in the week, this book deals with the controversial reading in Acts 12:4 and Easter and whether that is an acceptable translation. I believe that it is, although I have a different take on that issue than what you may have heard or be familiar with. So if you're interested, please consider checking out and picking up a copy of Don't Pass Over Easter as a way of supporting the ministry. We would certainly appreciate that. Also, as always, want to remind you about our Rumble channel here, Grace Life Bible Church on Rumble. We established this as an alt-text site. Should something happen to our YouTube ministry as a way of staying current and having an alternative, if you are into alt-text sites and would like an alternative to YouTube, please check us out here on Rumble. So earlier in the week, I did episode number 5 in giving my thoughts on the Textual Confidence Collective, and we talked about textual absolutism and the spectrum of pro-King James positions. And I had originally said in the video from earlier in the week that I was not going to comment anymore on episode 2 of the original collective, which is this episode right here, Textual Absolutism, A History. Even though I said that, I have since kind of rethought that. And there's one issue that is just mentioned by the men in the collective here in their original episode 2. That I do want to talk briefly about, and that is some things about Westcott and Hort. As you know, those of you who are familiar with this debate, you know that Westcott and Hort are often front and center in the conversation about textual criticism and translation. And oftentimes, many sensationalized things are shared and said in the argumentation related to Westcott and Hort. And I think that a lot of that is really missing the point. What matters the most about Westcott and Hort is what they believed about the text that they were working on. And that is what we want to look at in this particular video. And to tee this up, we're going to jump in around the 54-minute mark here. And Brother Mark Ward is going to say a couple things here related to Westcott and Hort. And then I will sort of get into what I want to cover in this video.
Textual absolutism of text now, again, not translation, and we got to keep those two things distinct for a lot of reasons, but it's easy to pick up the idea, as I certainly did when I was within King James Onlyism, that textual absolutism was the history of the church until some really stupid bad guys, Westcott and Hort, came along and ruined it all. I mean, sometimes I look at the way their views are represented, I think, I mean, what kind of dummy would ever accept the views of Westcott and Hort if this is what they actually said?
Tregellis.
But if you look at the history, textual absolutism does not reign even in text, let alone translation, as we've covered. So, Tim, we've kind of...
So, in that little short segment there, Brother Ward talked about Westcott and Hort and alluded to the way that Westcott and Hort are used in pro-King James argumentation. And, of course, Mark Ward is discussing this under the framework of the banner of their label, textual absolutism. And the thing that we got to keep in mind most front center when it comes to Westcott and Hort isn't necessarily what they were into with the ghostly guild, necromancy, all the sort of stuff that is commonly said about them. I'm more concerned about what did they believe about the text and translation. Now, Elijah Hicks in there mentioned Tregellis. Now, I happen to have a copy of Tregellis's An Account of the Printed Text of the Greek New Testament by Tregellis. And this is dated, if I'm not mistaken, it's in the 1854, is when this originally was written by Tregellis in 1854. And in this book, I have queued up here on the screen, page 99, notice this. It says, Lachman determined to cast aside the received text altogether and to edit in such a way as if it had never existed. Now, what Tregellis is talking about here is the print, is the Greek text printed by Lachman in 1881. And you can see Lachman's attitude here toward the received text, to the text of the Reformation. He determined to cast the received text aside altogether and to edit in such a way as if it had never existed. So we see in Lachman here a predisposition towards wanting to do away with the received text, to want to do away with the text of the Reformation. And editing and conducting textual criticism in such a way so as to cast it aside altogether and to edit a text as though it had never existed. Now, Porter, Sidney Porter, author of this book right here, Constantine Tischendorf, The Life and Work of a 19th Century Bible Hunter, also talks about Lachman. And we can see this, I believe this page number is not listed here in the Google Books entry, but here we can see, as Lachman said, down with the late text of the Textus Receptus and back to the text of the early 4th century. So we can see that in the first half of the 19th century, there is a movement amongst text critics to do away with the received text, to do away with the text of the Reformation. And this movement is going to influence and impact Westcott and Hort. And this is where I feel there we really need to look into this and try to understand some things about this. Okay. Now, I have a copy of The Life and Letters, The Letters of Hort. And we can see here on this page, this is in a letter, a dated letter from 1851, December 29 through 30, 1851, to Reverend John Ellington, where Hort, I believe he's age 23 at this point. Age 23. Notice what he says. And again, this is from 1851. He says, I had no idea till the last few weeks of the importance of texts, having read so little Greek Testament and dragged on with the villainous Textus Receptus. So here is Hort in a letter calling the Textus Receptus villainous, calling the text of the Reformation villainous. Okay, and on the same page, in the same letter, we can scroll down and we can see this statement right here. He says, think of that vile Textus Receptus leaning entirely on late manuscripts. It is a blessing that there are such early ones. So here we can see in the 1900s, in the 19th century, in the 1800s, excuse me, in the 19th century, we can see this shift happening away from the text of the Reformation towards a different mindset, a different thinking towards textual criticism. Okay. Now we see it with the Lachman quote. We saw it with the Tregellis statement that we just read, Porter following that up. And now we can see from Hort himself, him calling the Textus Receptus, he calls it villainous. And he calls it vile here, and that is his attitude toward the Textus Receptus. So Hort is part of a mindset that is happening that wants to do away with the text of the Reformation. Now, we can see another letter here. Let's go to page 250 of Volume 1 of the letters, Life and Letters of Hort. And we can look at some more things here. Related to his attitude about this. This is in a letter from 1853. This is an 1853 letter to the Reverend John Ellington, where he says some more things related to the attitude that he and Westcott have towards the text. Okay. And let's just scroll down here. Notice he says, I know except Westcott. So he is referring to Westcott in the context. Notice what it says. He and I are going to edit a Greek text of the New Testament some 2 or 3 years hence, if possible. Lachman and Tischendorf will supply rich materials, but not nearly enough, and we hope to do a good deal with the Oriental versions. Our object is to supply clergymen generally, schools, etc., with a portable Greek text which shall not be disfigured with Byzantine corruptions. So what did Westcott and Hort view? What was their view of the Reformation text? The Reformation text was vile and villainous, according to Hort, and he and Westcott, they have it as their goal as to replace the received text in the same vein as Lachmann with a text that is, quote, not disfigured with Byzantine corruptions. So we can see very plainly here that they have a bent towards getting rid of the text of the Reformation, the received text. This is what really matters in analyzing what Westcott and Hort said and did, is what is their attitude? They have it as their goal. And by the way, what happened in the revision committee was not simply an updating of the King James language. It was a replacing of the text of the Reformation with a fundamentally different text that resulted in a fundamentally different kind of English version. Now, if you don't believe me, you need to read the Dublin Review and what they said about it in May of 1881 when the Revised Version first came out and what their analysis of it was. The reality is that Westcott and Hort are in the same tradition as Lachmann, where they want to do away with the text of the Receptus. They call it vile, they call it villainous, and they want to edit a text that is not disfigured with Byzantine corruptions. Now, also in Volume 1, we can go to page 420 here in the PDF. Let's go to page 420, and we can see in an exchange with the Reverend J.B. Lightfoot here, starting on page 420, assuming my tech will cooperate with me here. Okay, just bear with me for a second. We will start right here on page 420, and this is in a dated letter 1860. So we've seen a dated letter from 1851, a dated letter from 1853, and now a dated letter from 1860, where Hort is definitely giving his thoughts and opinions on the text of the Reformation. Notice what he says. I'm not convinced that any view of the Gospels which distinctly and consistently recognizes for them a natural and historical origin, whether under a special divine superintendence or not, and assumes that they did not drop down ready-made from heaven, must and will be startling to an immense portion of educated English people. So let's stop there. What is Hort saying? He's saying that a view that the Gospels are not just sort of descend from heaven in a sort of inerrant way by some sort of divine superintendence is what he calls it, will be startling to an immense portion of the educated people of England. So he is aware, Hort is aware that his view is not going to be well received by the Christian public of Great Britain at this time. But so far, at least, Westcott and I are perfectly agreed, and I confess I had hoped that you too would assent. And if thus much be conceded, I cannot see that my supposed view is a whit more startling than Westcott's. Now pay attention carefully to what is said next. But I now feel that I must say a word about more general principles. If you make a decided conviction of the absolute infallibility of the New Testament, practically a sine qua non for cooperation, I fear I could not join you, even if you were willing to forget your fears about the origin of the Gospels. Notice, Hort is saying that he does not believe in the infallibility of the New Testament. In fact, he tells Lightfoot here that if Lightfoot wants, apparently they're discussing some cooperation on a project here, and if Lightfoot wants to make a belief in the absolute infallibility of the New Testament a sine qua non, or without which it cannot be, principle for cooperation, Hort says, I can't join you. I fear I could not join you, even if you were willing to forget your fears about the origin of the Gospels. I am most anxious to find the New Testament infallible and have a strong sense of divine purpose guiding all its parts, but I cannot see how the exact limits of such guidance be ascertained except by unbiased a posteriori criticism. What is Hort saying? Hort is saying that he does not necessarily believe in the infallibility of the New Testament. Now, here's a guy who doubts whether or not the New Testament is fundamentally reliable, and we're going to trust him to edit for us now and to recover for us the original. Now, look, guys, These are his words. Now, if we can also look at the 1881 Greek New Testament that Westcott and Hort published, and we can see here on page 110 where they're talking about, and by the way, I have a copy of this. This is an old copy from 1881 of the Westcott and Hort Greek New Testament. I have my own copy of this, and we can see here, 96, they're talking about application of principles of criticism to the text of the New Testament. And notice what Westcott and Hort say. They say the principles of criticism explained in the foregoing section hold good for all ancient texts preserved in a plurality of documents. In dealing with the text of the New Testament, here it is, no new principle whatever is needed or legitimate. But no other ancient text admits of so full and extensive application of the various means of discriminating original from erroneous readings which have been suggested to the scholars by the study of the conditions of textual criticism or textual transmission, excuse me. So what they are saying is that the Bible is like, they are treating the Bible like it is any other book. And they are saying that the Bible should be subject to the same standards of textual criticism that any other book that exists in a plurality of documents should be held to. So they are saying, and they are approaching their work from the presupposition that there is nothing unique, nothing distinct about the Word of God, that the Word of God is like any other book and should be treated using the same manners of and rules and approaches or what have you of textual criticism as any other book. And we just saw in the letter from 1860 to J.B. Lightfoot that Hort questioned strongly whether or not the New Testament was even infallible at all. Now we can also go to page 317 of this PDF. Let's do that. Let's go to page 317. And let's wait for that to load. We can see a very startling statement here. Notice the statement, quote, "Little is gained by speculating as to the precise point at which such corruptions came in." Now listen to the statement. "They may be due to the original writer, or to his amanuensis if he wrote from dictation, or they may be due to one of the earliest transcribers." Now you need to understand what Westcott and Hort are saying here. They are saying that textual corruption could have entered the text by the original writer or his amanuensis if he wrote from dictation. So you are talking about guys that did not even view the originals, the original autographic text as inspired or inerrant. Because they're saying here that error could have been in the first copy, which is totally at odds with the modern evangelical understanding of the originals only position, that the originals only are infallible and inspired, et cetera, et cetera. Westcott and Hort, the architects of the modern critical text, did not believe that, or they at least made concession that the original writer or writing by dictation through the amanuensis could have had corruption into the very first original copies or autographs of the text. Okay. Folks, these are the kinds of things that are lost in the conversation when the conversation is so thick with the rhetoric of Westcott and Hort, okay? There are major problems here, and they accent a move away from the text of the Reformation by men who called the text of Receptus vile and villainous, okay, and who thought it was disfigured by Byzantine corruptions, who thought that there's possible corruption and error in the very first originals written by the original author or by the amanuensis, and who do not believe that the New Testament is infallible. And yet we want to trust that this line of thought has bequeathed to the body of Christ a better understanding of the text and what the text is than what the Protestant reformers had in their understanding. So I think there are a lot of issues here that people need to think through, because it is certainly not as cut and dry as what the collective wants people to think. Now, I will concede to Mark Ward the following. The rhetoric in the pro-King James argumentation is so bad when it comes to Westcott and Hort that people don't really realize what the core issue is. The core issue is, what did they believe about the text? And their views on the text were the same as any other unbelieving textual scholar of the 19th century. And that seems to me to be an absolute fact. So I did want to address that issue before we moved on with our analysis of the Textual Confidence Collective. So really what we have, guys, is a choice between the historic Protestant view of the text and the view of 19th century unbelieving text critics. And the reality is that this Westcott and Hort text is still the fundamental basis for what has been built on top of it in the critical editions of the American Bible Society text and the Nestle Olam text. And they'll say, modern text critics will say, well, you know, we've given up, you know, trying to reconstruct the original. We're just looking for the initial text. Folks, that's just kicking the can. The reason they've given up on finding the original text is because they know they'll never know for sure if they found it. It is a non-falsifiable position. It's a non-falsifiable position. But I would say saying, well, we're not looking for the original text anymore, now we're looking for the initial text, is essentially the same thing. All you've done is kick the can. How are you going to know that you found the initial text apart from a view and an approach to criticism that is governed by biblical presuppositions, presuppositions related to the text that are stemming from a belief in the preservation of the text. So, you know, you need to, as you listen to this, you need to not read more into what I'm saying than what I'm saying. I'm trying to be very specific and very succinct in what I'm trying to communicate here. And that is that there is no doubt that the Protestant view of the text changed. It was reworked. It was redefined in the 19th century. And what happened is, especially at Princeton Theological Seminary, Warfield and Hodge, who were supposed to be the defenders of the Westminster Confession of Faith, took up a defense of the biblical text by meeting the German higher critics, etc., on terms set by them. And the result is a complete rewriting of it. And the reality is that if all the revision committee had done in the late 19th century is simply take the King James text, which is what I believe they were commissioned to do, and just update some of the words and so forth that were in that text to update them and make them using more modern equivalents, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. But that's not what happened. The underlying text was switched out, and the result of that was the production of a very new form of the text in the Revised Version in English that people had not seen heretofore. So those are my thoughts, and I want to remind you about our conference we just had. We just had a conference at Grace Life Bible Church on the weapons of our warfare, understanding the nature of our spiritual warfare. I'll make sure I put a link to that in the description for this video. I'm also going to include a link to a video where I dealt with the Dublin Review article from May 1881 when the Revised Version was first published, so you can read for yourself what was being said by a primary source at the time. And I will also remind you, if you don't mind, about our podcast that my wife and I have, the Just Grace It podcast with Brian and Becky Ross. And in our most recent episode, we offer our thoughts on Pastor Appreciation Month and your unique version of flesh. So next week, I hope to get back on track and get one of these videos out a week. We appreciate you tuning in. If you are enjoying this channel, if you are liking this content, if you would please like this video, share this video, leave a comment. make sure that you subscribe and ring the alarm bell as a way of staying current with what we're trying to do here on this channel. And if you've never trusted Jesus Christ, if you've never relied exclusively on his death for your sin upon the cross, his shed blood as the only total complete payment for your sin, his burial and his resurrection, believe that he died on the cross for your sins, was buried and rose again today before it's everlasting too late. Thanks for your attention, and we'll see you next time.